There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf, and welcome to my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. Have you ever tried everything to stop repeating a pattern in your life that you know is affecting yourself and your relationships? Maybe it's self-hate or substance abuse or not being able to sustain a relationship or just feeling stuck. Well, you are listening to the right podcast because today I dive deep into the world of attachment styles with Ty Gibson, who sheds light on how childhood experiences shape our adult relationships and how these early bonds impact our interactions with others. Ty challenges the conventional belief that attachment styles are fixed and unchangeable, offering hope to those who struggle with relationships. We talk about her story of addiction to show us change, peace, and freedom is possible. Let's dive in. Ty, it's so lovely to have you back on the podcast again. We had such a great conversation last time, so welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, congratulations. You have a new book about relationships, and it's called Learning Love, and I love that. And you tackle a subject that we talked about last time, but I wanted you to start off by just re-looking at that, because your book is very much based around attachment theory. But as you and I both know, those of that don't know this, there's a lot of controversy around attachment theory because there's a cultural bias and it's not really, there's some things that are very questionable. And I love your approach in that you challenge that they're also not fixed, that they can change, and there's that change, hope of change. So could you just talk a little bit to, before we dive into your book and relationships and things, let's just talk a little bit about attachment theory, maybe define it, talk a little bit about the controversy, and then how you believe that it's changeable, it's not fixed, which challenges the current theory of attachment.
Absolutely. So basically we have, the original work was from John Bowlby out of Cambridge University, and he studied a lot about the different attachment styles. And for anybody who's not familiar, there are four major attachment styles. We can maybe dig into them a little bit more in detail, but we have the securely attached style. Then we have the anxious, preoccupied attachment style, who tends to be more needy in relationships. The fearful, avoidant, or disorganized style, who tends to have a lot of chaos and be very hot and cold in relationships. And the dismissive, avoidant attachment style, who tends to be more fearing of commitment, a little bit more emotionally unavailable. And so that body of work built out of Cambridge University with John Bowlby was studied for quite a long time. And then somebody named Mary Ainsworth joined in and really help sort of iterate on how we can find somebody's attachment style. They did different experiments, one of them being the strange situation experiment. We could actually observe a child's attachment style between the ages of 0 to 2 years old, but they never discussed enough about how you can actually change your attachment style. And I think one of the biggest mistakes people make is they either think that because this is their attachment style, this is fixed forever and it's not changeable and it can't be rewired. And I think it's really important to recognize we're not born with an attachment style. It actually gets conditioned into us through, you know, the experiences that we have repetitively, and really follows programming in terms of how our subconscious and unconscious mind get programmed. And another big part is that there's a difference between somebody's personality versus their behavior. You know, sometimes we see that, oh, somebody's being a little bit avoidant and I'm just getting to know them, and they may not be interested, or they may not be compatible, or they may not be in a place where they're ready for a relationship. And it could be that their behavior is that, whereas their attachment style is a lot more fixed in terms of traits across our personality. And it's also something that can be still changed as we shift and heal and do that rewiring work.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that we shouldn't see them as cast in stone, and we shouldn't see them as something that's defining the rest of our life. It's not our destiny. It's very much related to our experiences, what we've experienced as we growing up, because you talk a lot about that as well. But then also a little bit about the cultural bias. There's also been a little bit of concern around attachment theory and the cultural bias. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yes. Will you get a little bit more specific in terms of what you mean by the cultural bias?
Well, that a lot of the research was done on mainly white people, you know, and not on many different cultures and very specific income groups and that kind of thing. So it was very specific parenting styles. So that's raised a little bit of questioning around how accurate they are and how fixed they are. So that's why I like your approach of they can change. So the concern has been more around, you know, that kind of thing. And it's so not to, because we can, people can
wear the research,
the label. Yeah. So there's been a bit of questioning around the research. And then people, when you talk about science and research, then people think, well, that label's fixed. And I just want people to realize that any kind of theory has always got a bit of bias in it. And we need to be aware of those and see it more as descriptions as opposed to labels that are fixed, which is your approach. But it's just, it would be good to talk a little about that.
Yeah, because there's different types of cultural bias that people will highlight. One, for sure, the actual grouping of where the research was done. But also some people will talk about how in different cultures we trend towards, like, you know, I had a conversation more recently with somebody from Japan, and they were saying, well, the vast majority of people here are more dismissive avoidant because culturally and societally, it's actually more important for individuals to be.
There you go.
Yeah. So you'll see a lot of, it depends where, I wasn't sure which cultural bias you were discussing, because there's a lot of different sort of discussions around that.
You're explaining that beautifully. Carry on. That's exactly what I wanted to bring up.
Yes. And so, of course, there's cultures that play a role because of the different conditioning processes. You'll also see in different cultures that will have it be more status quo to have a lot of enmeshment in the different dynamics or codependency. And that can be very positively reinforced in some cultures and very negatively reinforced in other cultures. So I do think it's important to see that. But again, going back to that original theme, we have this very important thing we have to remember. Our attachment style is not a diagnosis. It's not a disorder. It's not a cluster B personality disorder or anything of that nature. It's basically a subconscious set of rules that we learn about what we expect relationships to look like. So if you take a dismissive avoidant, for example, you know, a lot of their expectations in relationships are that people will be very independent, right? People will really make sure that they're taking care of their own needs. And there's not very much overlap in terms of relying on other people. If you look at an anxious preoccupied, there's a lot of expectation that people will soothe them and that they should be soothing other people. So we have these different expectations and these different rules based on the modeling we receive. And it's really this subconscious set of rules and expectations that are patterned in that are really affecting our attachment style as a whole.
No, I love that. Beautifully explained. That's really great. Now, you've written this new book about learning love. And one of the things you talk about is to how you can, individuals can build, and I'm just reading from here so I get this right, fail-proof relationships in less than 90 days. And I know that that's going to catch people's attention. So I'd love to talk about just big picture before we dive in, you know, why 90 days fail-proof relationships? It sounds almost impossible.
So there's a few core things that make up, you know, our original attachment style as we think of it and how we can actually change to become securely attached. So there's a few pieces of research that we did and we found that have a lot to do with how we can actually facilitate transformation. So the very first part is that individuals who are securely attached have less core wounds. So if you look at the idea of core wounds, essentially it's based in, it has roots in cognitive behavioral therapy. And what you'll see is that when we go through life and our experiences, whatever we're exposed to through repetition and emotion has a really big impact on our subconscious and unconscious mind. And so what will happen is, just as an example, if somebody grows up in a household where there's tremendous amounts of criticism, and maybe the parents in that household think they're preparing the child for the world, you know, the subconscious and unconscious mind will try to derive meaning, essentially. We'll give meaning to things and we'll say, okay, well, here, you know, I must not be good enough. And we'll sort of attempt to seek certainty. And in doing that, that will create programming. So we'll tend to think, okay, I am a not good enough person. And that will become one of our core wounds. And so as we have this experience of getting imprinted with these different core wounds, what will then happen is we'll tend to carry these ideas about ourselves at a subconscious and unconscious level as if it's part of our identity. So we'll think, okay, I am a not good enough person. Now, there's different variations for different attachment styles. We can think, okay, I will be abandoned. I will be alone. I will be excluded or disliked. And all of the different core wounds we look at from a cognitive behavioral therapy perspective are basically unconscious imprints on our mind that are there because of the repeated experiences we had to feeling this way. And so when we look at how we can actually change these core wounds, it's a big part of changing our attachment style. And research shows us it takes roughly 21 to 28 days to really reprogram some of these ideas about ourselves, where we start to form strong neural pathways, but then about 63 days for really those neural pathways to take hold. And so when we look at changing these ideas we have about ourselves, there's really powerful tools we can plug in to change these core wounds that are showing up in our relationships to begin with. So maybe we can circle back in a few moments to like a great tool that we can use to really start to reprogram. But there tend to be a couple other things that differentiate between a securely attached style versus insecurely attached style.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? That's brilliant. I want to just emphasize and underscore something. Two things. My audience is used to hearing that. And when you talked about unconscious and subconscious, I just want to orientate them. When you talk about the subconscious and the unconscious in terms of the research that I do and what I present to the audience, when you're talking about, in my language, you're talking about the non-conscious and the subconscious and the conscious mind. So just so that people know what we're talking about. And then when you spoke about 21 days and 63 days, My audience is really familiar. I do a lot of research in that. We've just published another couple of papers on the 63-day neurocycle, the healing journey, and this how the cycle takes six, not 21, as you quite, I'm so pleased you said that, because 21 days to build a habit is to change a psychoneurobiological network is a must. It doesn't happen. Changes will, a lot of reconstruction will happen, but habit formation requires at least another 42 days. And sometimes multiple if you're dealing with major core wounds that we're talking about. So I just wanted to underscore what you had said and orientate my audience, because we're speaking the same, we're saying the same thing, just using slightly different words. So
exactly.
I'm so pleased you brought up this 21 and 63. Good
job. Because we'll start to feel that momentum at that 21-day mark. We'll start to feel differently. We are like implementing these new patterns. But for those really deep things, you need that full 63 days to really have that actual transformation that lasts, I think is what you're saying as well.
Exactly. And the 21 days can be a danger zone, because that momentum, you can think, oh, I'm done. I'm fixed, or it's fixed, but it's not. It's just the pattern starting. You can slip back so easily into that attachment style that was a wounded version and impacting your relationship. Okay. So coming back to where you were at, you're leading up to why the 90 days, and then you're going to give us some tools.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the big first features that we want to dig into is those core wounds, right? We want to understand if I can recondition those core wounds, and we'll share a tool for that in a little bit, then that can shift and change dramatically. Because one of the big features of each attachment style being insecurely attached is that they're carrying these core wounds. So for example, the anxious preoccupied, having these core wounds of abandonment or exclusion or being disliked or not good enough, the dismissive avoidant having the core wounds of feeling like I am defective, or I will be unsafe if I'm vulnerable, or weak if I'm vulnerable. The fearful avoidant having a lot of core wounding around betrayal trauma, but also the abandonment. So, you know, we have these different dynamics that are really important to dig into. When we can recondition those things, we see a lot of transformation. The second big piece that differentiates between a securely attached style and an insecurely attached style is the relationship each has to their needs. So what we'll generally find is that securely attached individuals have a pretty good understanding of their needs, and they feel comfortable communicating those needs to others, but also meeting those needs in the relationship to themselves. So for example, a securely attached person can self-soothe, because if they need validation or encouragement, they can self-source those things, but they also have empowered communication tactics to be able to say to somebody, hey, you know what? I'm feeling a little bit down today. I could use some reassurance or validation. So they're comfortable self-sourcing and other sourcing in healthy, direct ways through powerful communication. All insecurely attached styles really struggle with that. So part of the journey towards becoming secure is actually doing that work. So as an anxious attachment style, some of their big needs tend to be gaining certainty, validation, reinforcement, being prioritized or made to feel special or wanted. And of course, they tend to struggle with giving those things to themselves the most. They tend to self-abandon, and they tend to put themselves down, be self-critical rather than self-compassionate or validating. So part of the healing journey is actually patterning in the ability to become that in the relationship to self. And you'll see sort of to juxtapose that as each attachment style has different needs, dismissive avoidance, they tend to really need empathy. They tend to need acknowledgement, appreciation for little things that they do. They tend to need safety in their relationships and harmony. And they also tend to really appreciate a sense of acceptance. But of course, if you look at the dismissive avoidant attachment style, because they have a lot of core wounds that relate back to shame, they very much struggle to accept themselves. They very much struggle to empathize with themselves. So part of their healing is to practice a daily habit of doing those things in a morning or evening routine, actually checking in with their emotions, actually being accepting and more forgiving to themselves if they make a mistake instead of so harsh and shaming of themselves. And so as we learn to self-source our needs, this has a huge impact on our ability to move from insecurely attached to securely attached. So we sort of have these first two categories, which is recondition the core wounds, learn to self-source our needs. And as we pattern this practicing in, we actually start seeing the rewiring take place. Now, there's a couple other important categories to dig into at a high level, and they are learning to have our boundaries and learning to communicate to others.
Okay, perfect. And before you dive into those, I wanted to ask you, this is really great. I've got a question here that I don't want to not ask. I want you to quickly just to land this in your own sphere of experience. Can you share a personal experience or realization that significantly shaped your understanding of love and relationships, which potentially inspired you to write this book? So, you know, you tell us about you and if there was something that, because it always comes from ourselves when we have a certain interest. I'd love to hear your experience.
Absolutely. So I definitely grew up as a fearful avoidant attachment style. People often hear the disorganized attachment style are the same thing. And essentially, I had a tremendous amount of chaos in childhood, a tremendous amount. And I really struggled in relationships. I thought that relationships were about fighting and arguing, and that was what love was. And I had a lot of big core wounds, tremendous around betrayal or abandonment or being trapped in the wrong relationship or experience. A lot of typical fearful avoidant, they have the anxious side of the core wounds and the dismissive avoidant side of core wounds. And so for me, actually, the first place I really started was in healing these core wounds. And I spent a lot of time doing reprogramming work because I realized quite quickly the burden of carrying these core wounds around was a lot more than the little bit of work each day to repattern or recondition them. And
what stimulated that, though? What got you to make that shift? Was it in a relationship that you were starting, or was it manifesting in some kind of a relationship or in yourself?
So honestly, it was that I actually, just before I turned 15 years old, I was addicted to opiates. So I had a knee surgery. I got addicted to opiates. I tried a lot of different things for healing and it wasn't working. And I was high functioning enough. I had a soccer scholarship and I was off playing soccer. And that's why I had the knee surgery to begin with. And I was just holding on to my life by a thread. Like I was maybe on the outside, things looked okay, but I was really not doing well on the inside. I was in a psych class in university and somebody said to me, the conscious mind can't outwill or overpower the subconscious mind. And as somebody who had on almost a daily basis for the better part of 4 or 5 years at that point, which went on for about 6 years in total before I got sober, I would constantly say, I'm going to get sober. I'm going to change. I'm going to stop using. I'm going to ignore this person that I get them from. I'm going to delete people's phone numbers. And then I would always go back to the same patterns. And I went to AA meetings, NA meetings, inpatient rehab, outpatient rehab. Things were not working for me. And I kept going to try to attend these programs like in the summer between first year and second year and these different things. And I just really was struggling. And when somebody said to me, your conscious versus your subconscious mind, it was like, oh my goodness, this is explaining to me what I'm experiencing. So I actually started off trying to, I did like a year long certification in hypnotherapy while I was still in university and really got so interested in these parts of how our mind works, because I realized like if we're just targeting, if we just have the insight, but we don't have the tools to recondition, then we're really left high and dry a lot of the time and really making a change. And to me, I felt like my life depended on it. I felt like my sobriety, my future really depended on it. And I would remember going into these meetings with people like AA meetings or NA meetings, and people would be like 100 days sober and they would be like, today was a war. It was such a struggle. I barely made it through the day not using. And I was like 18 or 19 going, what do you mean? Like, I can't fight this battle for my whole entire life. Like, there has to be a better way. So I was really interested when I first learned. One of the most interesting things too is I sat one day in meditation. Somebody told me I should meditate to start observing my thought patterns. And I sat for my very first time in meditation. I had never meditated. And I sat there and I was like, okay, listen to your thoughts. And I sat there and I found myself going, you'll never be able to do this. You're not going to be able to do anything. You're not. And I realized, oh my goodness, this is what I'm escaping. This is what I'm numbing all day. I'm numbing my own internal dialogue because it's terrible. No wonder I'm numbing it. And so I got really interested in how to actually reprogram because I realized if I could shift and change these patterns of thought that I was having, then I would have a lot of relief, which was definitely my experience. So got really into the core wounds, and then learning to meet my own needs was another really big part. And then began giving workshops for free to people while I was still in school. And that got into sort of this whole space. And eventually, about 9 years ago, had done a lot of healing, but then got into the relationship with my now husband and realized I still had like attachment dynamics going on that I hadn't really worked on, and then got really interested in attachment styles from there.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that. That really, you know, lands this why you have such a passion for this area and why it's because it's helped free you. And that's really, thank you for sharing that. And what I'm really just hearing you say in summary is that you had been to all the rehabs, you'd been to all the meetings, you had done all the, and we know there are, you know, people going back to rehab, it's, you know, it's very often multiple times. And then the whole thing, I'm so glad you brought up also in one of the meetings, the person struggling, and then you thinking, you don't want to do this the rest of your life because there's that message that you have a brain disease. You know, you're broken. You're going to struggle for this the rest of your life. And people are literally, that's wired into the network that they're going to have to struggle for the rest of their life. And that's causing more problems. And if you think of it, you so beautifully summarize. And I want to thank you for that. That's why I want to just emphasize and make sure people got what you said, that you did all the things you're supposed to do for addictions. And you mentioned alcohol and opioid and everything. And you spoke about a multiple year pattern. And the key that shifted you was the recognition of finding, hey, something's driving me. This is not who I am. This is who I've become because of something. And then you started recognizing that until you had changed that, you talk about it in your subconscious. I talk about it in the non-conscious, until you'd identified that toxic thought, that pattern inside of you, that network, that mind, brain, body network. Until you recognized what it was and started, your first step, correct me if I'm wrong, was to recognize that you've been driven by something. And if you need to find what was driving you, deconstruct that and reconstruct that and make that into a habit. And, you know, you talk about reprogramming. So we're saying the same thing just with different words. And that's where the shift happened in your life. Not all the I'm diseased, I'm going to struggle the rest of my life one day at a time. Multiple rehab, sharing your problems, all those helped, obviously, to a certain extent. But your shift came when you actually recognized you had been driven by something that was stuck and you needed to rewire that. Have I summarized correctly?
Like, so beautifully. And I love that you see how important it is too, because, you know, like one of the things, and I'll say this to anybody listening, and this is not me saying don't go to rehab or don't do programs.
No,
those things are good for
that.
Structure.
Yeah.
But what I do want to say to anybody listening is that, like, I don't struggle with, like, I don't even think about opiates. I don't even think about, like, I had my appendix out a couple of years ago and I was prescribed painkillers and it was my first time. Oh my goodness. It's been years and years, but I didn't even, they sat in my house somewhere and then I moved and I probably threw them out somewhere. Like, I didn't even think about it. It wasn't
beautiful.
And
you
it's not free. A struggle. Yeah. And it's because I did a lot of that core wound reprogramming, meeting my own needs and learning to self-soothe and deconstructing the programming that was very unhealthy, coming from a very tumultuous household, and learned to reconstruct in a way that actually brought me a lot more peace. And so,
beautiful.
Yeah. Go ahead.
This is so beautiful. Sorry. I just want to know, how did that, because you said when you got into a relationship 9 years ago with your current husband, you saw some of those wounds playing out there. So you'd done the work, and this goes to two things. You talk a lot about how we can change, which is what I talk about on this podcast all the time. So you're not stuck in an attachment style. You changed that. You recognized, and the attachment style gave you language to explain how you were stuck. You did the work to get set free. You could have an appendix out and not get stuck. You could use the opiates correctly to help with the pain, but not as a dependency. And then you went into something new, which was a relationship. So this is life. We get something under control and then we get put into another situation where our past to a certain extent raises its head and you recognize something else. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because was it the same?
Absolutely.
And benefit in a different way because of a different circumstance? Go ahead.
It's such a great question. So what I found is that I went into a lot of healing on my own, and I spent about 4 years being fully alone as I was in this like sobriety and hyper intense learning space and healing. And I was just obsessed and so passionate about learning all these different things. And so, you know, did all these interesting certifications and was in school the whole time and just really, really pushing. So learned a ton, got very, very peaceful in the relationship to myself. I felt so at peace, and I felt this really deep need to protect that peace. Like, oh no, what if I get into a relationship and somebody distracts me or I go backwards? And what was so interesting is that what I found is I was really good at self-regulating at that point and really good when I was on my own, but I hadn't learned the tools yet to regulate through and with somebody else. And so that required me learning to be more vulnerable, which was terrifying to me. Like, I had it all together finally after years of chaos.
Never did anyone see anything.
And so I needed to learn to actually share. And I remember, you know, being able to work through when I was triggered very, very well and get back to emotionally regulated. But I wasn't preventing somebody from triggering me by telling them what was hurting me or upsetting me. So I had almost done all this work on like reprogramming my own core wounds and meeting my own needs and doing nervous system regulation for me. But what I realized is that for healthy interdependency, we actually need to be masters at both. So I need to be good at regulating through myself, but also being able to go to my partner and say, hey, you know, when you said that a moment ago, that actually really hurt me. I'm sensitive to you saying things like that. Or, hey, there's something I need more from you in the relationship, and it actually looks like ABC. And so what I learned is that the other part of becoming securely attached, and learned this on my own first, was that not only do we have to be able to self-regulate, but we have to be able to co-regulate, meaning we have to be able to share those needs and share our feelings and open up and set boundaries effectively with other people. And those are really the other main parts of what it takes to become securely attached. The first three parts on our own are the core wounds, meet our own needs, learn to emotionally regulate through nervous system work, you know, meditation, breath work, things that keep us more in parasympathetic nervous system mode. And the other half of it really becomes, I need to learn to communicate vulnerably and authentically to somebody in my life and let them know if they hurt or affect me. And I need to learn to share my needs with somebody. Hey, sometimes in the relationship, I need more time together. Or sometimes in the relationship, I need to do my own thing. I need to be able to communicate in a way what my truth is to a partner and receive support. So communication and actually opening up to also be able to set boundaries are really the other parts of what it takes to become securely attached from the interdependent space. So I'm co-regulating with somebody else as well.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Relationships are tough, but they make life worth it. We are made for community, but sometimes navigating that community can be a challenge. A common misconception about relationships is that they have to be easy to be right. Sometimes the best ones happen when both people put in the work to make them great. Whether we are talking about romantic partnerships, friendships, family members, or co-workers. And therapy can be a place to work through the challenges you face in all of your relationships, whether it is with friends, work, your significant other, or anyone. Indeed, talk therapy is for so much more than working through a past trauma or current problem. It can also help us learn to thrive in every area of our lives, including our relationships. It is not just for when something is going wrong, but also for those times we feel we can learn to grow in specific areas of our lives. I personally have found that talking to someone I trust so helpful when it comes to family dynamics. The outside perspective helped me gain more insight and wisdom into what to do to improve my own relationships and manage delicate situations. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/drleaf today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/drleaf. The link and details will be in the show notes. Beautiful. So this is what I'd love us to do. I love how you've described this. I want to take your story because now people have heard that and it's very relatable. And I think it's wonderful how you described that. And I want to take use your story as the example and let's give some, or you give, not me, some techniques and tips. I couldn't speak there for a moment on the two elements that you've just described. So literally exactly what you've just said, but now link it back to an actual technique. So someone who's sitting in the, obviously they'll go to your book and they'll get all the detail, but just to start people off, let's talk about this working on the self and then working on the relationship, because your book is Learning to Love, Learning Love. And that's loving yourself and loving others. So your life is just such a great example of it. Does that make sense? Can you take us through?
Absolutely.
Very, slowly, carefully, self first. These are the three things. And here's an example, a technique of each. And this is how I did it. And then the interdependence. You started saying that, but I wanted to just, make it more clear for people so they can really understand it and start applying and then get
Absolutely.
Your book to get the details.
Absolutely. So for myself personally, the first parts were the core wounds. So I had a lot of core wounds around, let's just, some easy ones were around fearing that I would be betrayed. So fearing that I couldn't trust and fearing that I would be abandoned. So those were two big things. And obviously that dates back to a lot of childhood experiences. So one of the first things I did is I looked at, okay, well, why is it possible for me to have loyalty in relationships? And what I did is for that 63-day period, I would come up with the reasons that loyalty was possible. And I would come up with evidence. So you can think of your conscious mind as speaking more through language. And in your words, the non-conscious mind as speaking more through like emotion and imagery, and that being really necessary to create that patterning in there. And so what I would do is come up with actual memories, right? There was loyalty in this particular case, that particular case, because every memory is a container for emotions and images. And when you look at things through that hypnotherapy lens, that's what we're really trying to use to imprint our subconscious and unconscious mind. So we're really trying to get that emotion and imagery. So I started for that 63-day period and I would do, I'm worthy of loyalty because, or loyalty is possible for me because, and I would come up with pre-existing memories or anything that was a container for emotions and images, like other memories of other people I saw in loyal relationships, things like that. And I would keep writing them out and then recording
you're
them in my
positive. Sorry, I just want to make sure you understand. You recognize the problem and you were working on the reconstruction. So you were giving yourself
exactly.
evidence of how to reconstruct. So this is the case, but this is the information telling me that something's wrong. Let's reconceptualize to find, and you're doing your reconceptualization by identifying evidence over time.
Exactly.
Wired. Okay.
Exactly. And so that evidence gives you that emotion, gives you that imagery and starts to really create those imprints. So I would do that. And sometimes I would write new ones, but a lot of times I would just record them into my phone and listen back to them either first thing in the morning or last thing before I went to bed, because we're more suggestible during those times because generally we're producing a little more alpha brainwaves. So I would really try to pattern those things in a hyper suggestible way. I did the same thing for abandonment. Instead of I am abandoned, I'm worthy of connection and maintaining connection with people as possible because, and come up with those pieces of evidence. So I really did that strongly. And I would do sometimes two core wounds at a time and listen back to them and really feel about it and see it and imagine it. And so that was the first part. And the second part was the needs part. So as I was doing that, I also learned I have to stop abandoning myself and not being loyal to myself. And so sometimes I realized that from those wounds, I would be disloyal to myself because I wouldn't honor my own boundaries, or I wouldn't speak up and use my voice, or I wouldn't stay connected to myself. I would people please other people. So I learned I have to meet my own needs by making sure that those things that I would need from somebody else in a perfect world, I'm actually being able to give in the relationship to myself. And I made a daily habit of practicing that and making sure that I checked in with it in the evening.
Very specific. Mm.
Yes. Did I betray myself in some way today? How can I make sure I counteract that? Did I abandon myself in some way? Making sure that I stay connected to myself and my truth. And so, I would work on meeting those needs that came often out of those unmet needs from childhood that produce those core wounds. So I really made an effort to be on top of those things. There are other needs that we have as an attachment style. I needed, you know, growth. I needed a sense of safety, you know, and I would make sure I was meeting those needs regularly. I would generally pick three focus needs at a time. And as I felt like I was really in a great space with getting these needs met, and hey, I'd spent a couple months of really getting these needs met by myself, now I can move on to the next needs and I can go from there. So I really made the effort to reconstruct my relationship to these needs in this healthy way. So that was the next really big piece. And the third thing that I did in relationship to self is I did meditation every day. I was really into meditation. I knew that that was going to have an impact on getting out of this sympathetic nervous system mode that I was often in a lot of fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, and then getting into parasympathetic. So getting into that rest and digest mode and being able to be in my body, more comfortable, more present, more safe. And so I did, you know, just a daily habit in the morning and evening. I was really into this. It doesn't have to be that extensive for anybody, but I would do, you know, sometimes a 45-minute meditation in the morning, sometimes one in the afternoon and evening. I really loved meditation. And really, we only need 10 minutes in the morning and evening, essentially.
As much as you want. But what I love what you're saying is you did what you needed at the time. And that's what people can do. If it's 2 minutes or if it's 45 minutes, three times a day. And what's so good about, I want to make sure people got this, but you did the meditation, but you weren't doing that alone. Because as you and I both know, the research shows if you just meditate, it brings stuff up. And if you don't have a way of processing, you'll get worse. So you're doing a lot of other work with that. You're not just meditating. You were doing, that was part three. You did two other parts too, to work on the self. So that's amazing. Okay. So anything else on the self? Were you ready to move over to the, give us some examples of
others.
Needing to co-regulate with others.
Beautiful. Yeah, exactly. So those are the big three focus areas of myself. And then when it came to with others, it was really about communication and boundaries. And so there was a couple of really interesting things that I learned as I started to study communication a lot more. And one of the first things was I learned the big difference between communicating reactively versus positively framing our communication. So there's a big difference between saying something to somebody like, you don't care about me, you never spend enough time with me, versus saying something like, hey, I miss you this week. I feel a little disconnected. I'd love to plan something fun to do together this weekend.
I love that. Such a good reconceptualization. Yeah.
And one really gets us heard because somebody hears what we're needing and it's so clear. The other, it really trips somebody else's defense wires. It really gets them into a space of feeling like, oh my goodness, I'm on defense. You're accusing me of something. And so really our needs get lost. We're trying to communicate, but we do it in this negatively framed way. So positive framing goes a very long way. The second thing I learned a lot about as I went into studying more about communication is that a lot of people see communication as different things. So I might say to somebody, I need support, and they think that means doing more chores around the house. But maybe for me, that means I need a hug or I need encouragement. And so the second piece, the rule that I would always practice applying was paint a picture for what this looks like. Don't just say I need support or I need encouragement or I need more time together. I need more time together. And that looks like one date night every single week, no matter what. Or I need more support. And that looks like I need a hug sometimes when I'm feeling stressed. So being really specific goes a long way in terms of communicating. And the other rule of communication is that when we want to really be good communicators, it requires embodiment. It doesn't, you know, we're not doing a great job. There's a lot of work out there right now going around saying, tell your needs to your partner, communicate your needs. And I think what's happening is people are like, I need you to be all of these things. And because I communicated it once, you better always do it and never forget. And they're not doing it in a healthy way where they're positively framing or getting specific. And it's also with this like demand that because I did it once, you'll always remember. And the reality is we all have these different programmings exactly according to our attachment style. We tend to see, you know, and from many other places that we get our programming, but we tend to see relationships as, you know, through how we grew up a lot of the time. So we have to, if somebody has a different attachment style than us, don't be afraid to remind somebody, oh, hey, you know, quality time is really important to me. I noticed we fell off a little bit the past couple of weeks. Let's plan something fun again this weekend. I really want to make sure we're on top of this. Like we can see our needs through. And so that's embodiment, is that I can take my ability to know what I need and I can actually go into any situation with a family member, a friend, a romantic partner, you know, really anybody and let them know, hey, there's something that I want to work on here together. And being able to do it in a healthy, positively framed way that's very specific, that's embodiment. It's not, I did it once when I was triggered and I now I communicated my needs. And obviously there's a difference if somebody never makes an effort towards your needs. That may be a question of, are you in the right relationship?
Exactly.
The person never cares. Yeah. But
so there's a time for the flexibility and compassion and empathy and building and kindness. But if you're constantly doing that and the person's still not meeting, then that's where the boundary and the questions about, is this the right relationship, come up. It's what you're saying. This is amazing. So you go into this in a lot of depth. First of all, thank you for sharing from your own life. I think it makes it so real and easier to understand, because there's so many psychological terms out there that it always worries me. And especially you and I both, I think we discussed this before on social media. There's just so much that people can misunderstand things, but having a story to anchor it to is so lovely. So thank you for sharing your story and for attaching it to that. And the details, your book's wonderful. It really does walk people through it in a great way and give so much hope for being able to change. So where can people get hold of your book and where can people get hold of you or find out more about you?
Thank you. Yes. So my book is available on Amazon and in certain bookstores. And also the easiest way is Amazon.com for now. And then I have a website called personaldevelopmentschool.com where we have an attachment style quiz that helps sort of give a breakdown through a very long series of questions. And I put daily YouTube content out at personaldevelopmentschool-tidyskipson.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for doing that. It's so much help for people to be able to improve and move forward. So that's really wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast again. And do you have any closing words that you'd like to share, any piece of wisdom that you'd love to share?
Yes, I would say one thing, which is if we're learning about our attachment trauma or attachment styles and we realize, oh my goodness, I have these wounds or I behave in these sorts of ways, I think just one leaving piece of advice is to be compassionate to yourself. You know, these are not things that are your fault. They are your responsibility, but they are not your fault. And these aren't things we asked for. These are things that usually got patterned into us because of challenging experiences. And not only can they absolutely be changed, but you want to have that compassion to yourself and for yourself in the process of healing.
That's so well said. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I've really enjoyed chatting to you again.
Thank you so much. And I've really enjoyed speaking with you too.
I hope you found today's podcast interesting and helpful. If you want more tips and help with managing anxiety, depression, and mental health, be sure to visit my website at drleaf.com. And to sign up for my weekly newsletter, where I also include a schedule of my speaking events and so much more. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just look for Dr. Caroline Leaf. Also, I love seeing all your posts on social media about this podcast. I love seeing what resonates with you and what you've learned. So be sure to continue posting and tagging me and letting me know what you think and how these tips worked out for you. And don't forget, leave a review and keep spreading the word about this podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you learned something new and helpful. Till then, I'm Dr. Caroline E. This podcast represents the opinions of myself and my guest. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for educational and informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional for any individual medical questions you may have. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors.